So move to the next case of the morning, which is Andrew Lockhart versus Chandler. Mr. Shapiro.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Michael Shapiro, and I'm here today on behalf of the petitioner appellant, Andrew Lockhart. Your Honors, I want to make two key points from our briefs today, if I may. The first is to emphasize the due process violation that has occurred with regard to Mr. Lockhart's plea bargain. Essentially, the state has failed to fulfill its terms of that plea bargain and instead is imposing a substantial addition to Mr. Lockhart's sentence now.
Yeah, but the remedy for if the state that it breached the agreement is to set the agreement aside.
That is
not to knock out a part of it, and you get to keep the benefit of everything else.
That is one possible remedy, Your Honor, but I believe this court and the Illinois Supreme Court just in the last 6 weeks has explored an alternative remedy. This court, in the Russo case and in the Ferris case, has twice held that when a criminal defendant has begun to perform on his part of a plea bargain, the state has to be held to the terms of that bargain. Now, that's based on the Supreme Court precedent set in Santabello, which held that when the state enters a plea bargain, the state has to be held to the terms of that bargain. Now, the Whitfield case, which was recently decided by the Illinois Supreme Court, relying on both Santabello and this court's Ferris opinion,
But it's clear here that you're not challenging the guilt. You don't want to withdraw your guilty plea.
No, we're not seeking to withdraw the guilty plea here, Your Honor. We're seeking to have 3 years taken off of Mr. Lockhart's term of imprisonment, thus allowing the state to enforce its 3-year mandatory supervised release term. Mr. Lockhart agreed to a 35-year sentence when he entered his guilty plea, and that's the only sentence he should be held to.
How old is he?
Mr. Lockhart is, I believe, just short of 40 years old, Your Honor.
And it's a 35-year sentence. Typically in Illinois, how long would he serve?
I believe there is good time provisions that he would allow him to leave jail at a time before the 35-year sentence, before 35 years had run. However, Your Honor, what Mr. Lockhart agreed to was a 35-year sentence under Illinois law. Whether that includes good time off or
I'm not disputing that. I'm just curious how much difference this 3-year supervised release is going to mean to him by the time he gets out of prison.
The 3-year supervised release is a substantial addition, as this court has recognized on previous occasions in Baker, Ferris, Miller, and Russo. Excuse me, Your Honor. And it's of a due process constitutional violation. That's why, and when you serve a mandatory supervised release term, you're under severe restrictions. You're not incarcerated anymore, obviously, but you're restricted on when you can change employment. You're restricted on who you can associate with.
How old is he going to be when he gets out?
I believe he will
75?
No, I believe he will be in his early 40s, as the state has currently...
Well, that was my question about a 35-year term. How long is he going to serve? I'll ask the state that. That's all right.
Well, I think it's impossible to know, because while he always can get out on parole, but that's always within, you know, a determination by the state, so it's impossible to say until it happens.
When you're advising a defendant that you're going to serve 35 years, you at least give him parameters how long he might serve of those 35 years, right?
Mr. Lockhart was not given parameters in this case.
His counsel would give him parameters. It's my view, for example, if you keep your nose clean while you're in, you get to receive a sentence of 35 years, you'll be out probably at X.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, you also say that he, given good time, that he got 35 years, but it was subject to Illinois law.
Yes, Your Honor.
And also under Illinois law is a mandatory supervised release.
Yes, Your Honor. Mr. Lockhart does not dispute that mandatory supervised release is imposed on all sentences of this nature under Illinois law, nor do we dispute that the state has a compelling interest in supervising recently released ex-convicts. The problem is that mandatory supervised release under state law can't be imposed in violation of due process. What we're seeking by asking the court to strike 3 years...
Where's the due process violation here? You know, I can't believe, looking at this, that he wouldn't have pled guilty if you told him he had 20 years of supervised release after he gets out.
Yes, Your Honor, but the due process violation here comes in two respects. Starting with the Boykin case 1969, the Supreme Court held that all criminal pleas must be made knowingly and voluntarily. A year later in Brady...
You don't allege here that it was a knowingly and
Mr. Lockhart has stated in his affidavit that he was never apprised of the mandatory supervised release
term.
So
are you saying it was that his plea was not knowingly entered into here?
I am with respect to the mandatory...
Then the remedy has to be to vacate the plea.
I don't believe that's necessary, Your Honor, because under Santabello, it is possible to hold the government to its... Mr. Lockhart's entitled to the benefit of his bargain. Santabello and Ferris make clear, Your Honor, that in these situations, a criminal defendant should receive the benefit of his bargain in making the guilty plea. The Ferris court also pointed out that where a criminal defendant has begun to execute his conditions of the plea, i.e., entering the guilty plea and beginning to serve time, then it's unfair to make him replead and go back, especially where here he's been incarcerated for well over a decade. The situation there is to hold the government to its side. We recognize that there's a state law provision that to remove the 3-year mandatory supervised release term would violate state law. So what we're looking here is to square that state interest with Mr. Lockhart's constitutional protections, and that's to remove 3 years from his term of imprisonment, Your Honor. As I was saying a moment ago, this court, following the Supreme Court precedent of Boykin and Santabello for years, has recognized that that defendants in Mr. Lockhart's situation are entitled to have the benefit to receive their benefit of their bargain. And in response to a question you also asked a moment ago, Judge Evans, is not for a plea to be knowing and voluntary under Brady, the defendant must know the direct consequences of making that plea. Here, Mr. Lockhart undisputably did not know the direct consequences of making that plea. The state has conceded that he was never admonished about his mandatory supervised release term, and there's been no evidence ever to the contrary on that point. Mr. Lockhart essentially was told by the trial judge at sentencing, and the trial judge went on a colloquy about how he had spent a long time on this case, worked with counsel, and that he felt 35 years was appropriate, and he stated very clearly to Mr. Lockhart, if you enter this plea, I will sentence you to a 35-year term in the Illinois Department of Corrections.
Yeah, that's what he got in the Illinois Department of Corrections.
That is what he received, Your Honor.
And then when the supervisor released, this is the thing. I suppose he didn't advise him to say, if you really keep your nose clean, you're going to be able to get out a lot sooner than 35 years. He didn't tell him that either, did he?
No, he did not, Your Honor.
And he just, but that is the state law.
The state law effect of that, Your Honor, has no bearing on whether he agreed to a 35-year term, whatever that means under state law. The state could take away the good time law provisions tomorrow, and I believe there's case law out there that Mr. Lockhart could not claim a due process violation for that because he agreed to 35 years. Whatever the state legislature has decided to say a 35-year sentence means, Mr. Lockhart only agreed to whatever a 35-year sentence is.
He had a low of 20 and a high of 60 for first-degree murder.
That is correct.
And that's what the judge spent the time on in these negotiations and whatever else they did to come up with that number.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And that's the hard number. I guess what you're saying is, well, even though there's a mandatory supervised release, they didn't mention that, and therefore he wouldn't have, he didn't plead guilty to that.
He didn't plead guilty.
He didn't agree to that when he pleaded guilty.
No, he did not, Your Honor. While there is a 20 to 60-year range, he was given a hard number of 35, not 35 plus an extra 3 years of punishment that we're not telling you about. I see I've moved into my rebuttal time, if I may, Your Honor. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Benton.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Russ Benton. I'm here on behalf of the respondent, and I would ask the court to affirm district court's opinion. But first, before I start my argument, I wanted to mention that in terms of what the sentence that Mr. Lockhart will have, he was given a 35-year sentence or pled to a 35-year sentence in 1993. So he will get day-to-day credit, and he should be released on parole in 17 and a half years. And, in fact, I do believe his parole date is 2010.
So it's a two for one. I mean, it's one good time, one day,
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honors, in 1981, 10 years after the decision in Santabella versus New York and 12 years after the decision in Boykin versus Alabama, the United States Supreme Court granted certiorari in Lane v. Williams, a habeas case from this court. The issue to which cert was granted, and I'm going to quote, was whether the failure of the trial court to advise respondents of the mandatory parole requirement before accepting their guilty pleas deprived them of due process of law. By granting cert on this issue, the court was considering a question it left unanswered in Santabello and Boykin. In Lane, the court ultimately found that the respondents' claims were moot and did not rule on the issue, leaving it unresolved. The Supreme Court has not revisited this issue. 24 years later, this court granted a CA to the issue of, in this case, and again I quote, whether the state trial court violated the petitioner's due process rights by failing to notify him that a mandatory three-year term of supervised release would be appended to his sentence. That is the very same issue that the Supreme Court did not resolve in Lane. The facts in Lane in this case are the same. In both cases, during plea acceptance, neither the judge nor the prosecutor nor the defense counsel informed respondents of the three-year MSR term. In both cases, each petitioner, or in Lane, multiple petitioners, filed a habeas petition that they were not informed of the attachment of MSR and that their due process rights were violated. And in both cases, neither asked that they be allowed to plead anew. The claims of the constitutional violations are the same in Lane. And again, I quote, the respondents claim their constitutional rights were violated when the trial court accepted their guilty pleas without informing them of the mandatory parole requirement. And here, the petitioner claims his constitutional rights were violated when the trial court accepted his guilty plea without informing him of the mandatory parole requirement. The Supreme Court did not find a due process violation in Lane. Therefore, the question of whether the failure to advise respondents of a mandatory parole before accepting their guilty pleas deprived them of due process of law has been left unresolved by the Supreme Court. What has changed between 1982, when Lane was decided, and today for federal habeas cases is the promulgation of the AEDPA. For any habeas petitioner to gain relief under the AEDPA, he must meet the standard of 28 U.S.C. 22454D. Relief shall not be granted with respect to any claim that was adjudicated on the merits in state court proceedings unless the adjudication of the claim resulted in a decision that was contrary to or involved an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States. And despite holdings from the state courts, such as the Illinois Supreme Court in Whitfield, or this court in Baker and Miller, under the clear rules of the AEDPA, the petitioner cannot gain relief on his claim. This court has said in Schaff v. Snyder and Henry v. Page that it cannot rely on its own precedent from prior to the AEDPA to grant a writ. A petitioner must have a Supreme Court case to support his claim, and the Supreme Court decision must have clearly established the relevant principle as of the time of his direct appeal. Here, the Supreme Court had the exact issue before it and did not decide the issue. The Supreme Court affirmatively said it was not going to decide the issue. The Supreme Court has never held that failure to admonish a defendant about MSR violates due process, and thus there is no clearly established federal law as determined by the Supreme Court of the United States, and the petitioner cannot satisfy the mandatory guideline of 2254D. This case is very similar to the U.S. Supreme Court's recent decision in Cain versus Garcia Espicha, where there was a general issue. In that case, the general issue was the Sixth Amendment right to self-representation of Feretta. But the court looked at a specific issue, access to the library. Because there was no Supreme Court precedent that resolved the specific issue, it was not found contrary, and petitioner was unable to gain relief of the AEDPA. Here, the general issue is a guilty plea, but the specific issue, the mandatory release rules, were not at issue in Santabella and Boykin. They were at issue in Lane in this case. And similarly, in Hill v. Lockhart, the Eighth Circuit on a habeas case denied relief, and the Supreme Court said, and I quote, we have never said the U.S. Constitution requires the state to furnish the defendant with information of parole eligibility for a guilty plea to become voluntary. Now, that is a slightly different issue than what is present here, but it is consistent with longstanding Supreme Court law. Never said equates to no existing precedent. Supreme Court silence on an issue cannot constitute clearly established law. If there is no Supreme Court precedent on an issue, and Lane is explicit that there is none on the issue presented here, a state disposition can't be contrary to United States Supreme Court precedent. And thus, Your Honor, we would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Out of curiosity, when you have good time, and let's just say this is reduced to 17 and a half years, and then you have 3 years of mandatory supervised release, is there any other provision for the balance of the time that was, we'll call it eradicated, that he is subject to some kind of supervision or parole or anything else? Or is that the end of it?
I believe that is the end of it. After he has finished what his finished his sentences, and he finishes the mandatory supervised release.
So basically, he's earned half the term.
He's earned per day-to-day credit.
Okay.
But again, Your Honors, it is our belief that because there's no contrary law and no clearly established law by the U.S. Supreme Court, that this court should deny the petitioner's arguments and affirm the district court.
When you're giving day for day credit or the half time, ends up counting. Does that include the 3 year mandatory supervised release?
Your Honor, I'm not. I don't think so, but I'm not. I can't tell the court with surety about that.
No, because half of that would be.
One and a half years.
And if he's another year and a half that he'd have to serve.
No, he has the mandatory 3 years, so I believe he would serve the 3 years of mandatory supervised release.
But it's not half of 38.
Excuse me?
It's not half of 38. You don't get 19 years.
No, it would be half of the 35, and then he would get his MSR, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thanks. Mr. Shapiro?
Thank you, Your Honors. There's two brief points I would like to make. In the supplemental authority we provided to this court, the Illinois Supreme Court's more recent Whitfield decision, the Supreme Court there was dealing with a 25-year sentence enacted as part of a plea bargain. Now, with that 25-year sentence, the Illinois Supreme Court was obviously well aware of the possible good time provisions under Illinois law and the Illinois law on mandatory supervised release. And relying on Santabello and this court's decisions following Santabello, the Illinois Supreme Court still held that there was a due process violation that occurred by forcing the defendant there to serve a mandatory supervised release in addition to the 25 years. And he was explicitly in the sentencing, like our case here, promised just 25 years. The other point I would like to respond to is the state's reading of Lane versus Williams, which is far too broad. By the time Lane v. Williams had gone to the U.S. Supreme Court, it was already well established under Boykin, Brady, and Santabello that a criminal plea must comport with due process, and that the state should be held to the must be held to the terms of that plea bargain. The actual language comes from footnote 9 of the Lane v. Williams decision. Says, "We do not decide whether to establish such a constitutional violation. Respondents must claim they did not know of the parole requirement at the time they pleaded guilty." We're talking about what a criminal defendant has to plead to state this due process violation. That's not even an issue here because Mr. Lockhart very clearly has pleaded that he did not know of the mandatory supervised release term when he entered his plea deal. There's been no evidence to the contrary to that point, and I believe the state has conceded it. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thanks very much. This case will be taken under advisement. I understand you were court-appointed, is that right?
Yes, that is correct.
I appreciate your taking the assignment and your fine advocacy for your client.
Thank you, Your Honor.